Listen to this bullshit. This is our world now. The world of the electron and the switch, the beauty of the bond. We exist without nationality, skin color, or religious bias. You wage wars, murder, cheat, lie to us and try to make us believe it's for our own good, yet we're the criminals. Yes, I am a criminal. My crime is that of curiosity. I am a hacker, and this is my manifesto. Huh? Right? Manifesto? You may stop me, but you can't stop us all.
Oh, that's cool.
Cool?
Yeah, cool.
You think it's cool?
It's cool.
It's not cool. It's commie bullshit.
Egos in check. I want the money, the power, respect, and I heard you on so and so. You're not a threat, cause I really know so and so. They like my family, so they go pretend that they cool till they bust at your
movie. I'm getting good at my flow, been like butter, my check in a bank. They see the number. That movie made me want to be a hacker when I saw it. So that movie Hackers came out in 1995. And I feel like there's so much of it now that resonates with me more now than ever before in my whole life. A bunch of hackers trying to help a friend who was framed by a corporation for hacking into the Gibson and stealing data, which incriminated the main IT guy and one of the VPs of the company for a scam and extortion. And the company was soliciting the help of the federal government, who's too stupid to look out for the best interests of their citizens and just went along with it locked up. If you haven't seen Hackers, I highly recommend checking it out. It's an oldie but a goodie. So anyways, that manifesto was kind of actually popped up somewhere recently. I heard it and I was like, oh man, that's so great. It's so more fulfilling now than ever before in my life. And I just love it. So hey everyone, Simon for the Closed Network Privacy Podcast, episode 56, coming at you April 20th, 10:12 in the evening, 10:12 p.m. Enjoying a nice ranch water, blackberry, got a couple of drinks on the desk to keep me going. Of course, got the nicotine Zens going too. Should be a fun episode. So before I get into anything, I'll just kind of do a quick run through what I'm going to talk about. But first, I want you to, if you're driving, don't close your eyes. But if you're not driving or like on a treadmill, like just think about this. A security researcher in the UK opened a settings file on his phone. He deleted 6 lines of text. He typed a new PIN. And he walked right past the European Union's brand new age verification system in under 2 minutes. And that same day, the president of the European Commission stood on a stage in Brussels and told reporters the app was, air quotes, technically ready. And the hackers called it homework. So tonight, I'm going to be going into what's tonight for me. I don't know. It may not be tonight for you, but it's tonight for me. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about that story, plus a U.S. bill that could bake age verification directly into the operating system of pretty much everything in the United States. I'm going to cover a little bit about Meta's face scanning smart glasses and 30 lawmakers demanding answers from ICE and Palantir, an FBI case where the Bureau pulled deleted Signal messages off of an iPhone without ever breaking Signal's encryption. And then a real security incident at Versal that started inside an AI tool nobody audited. And also about Section 702, there are 10 days, well, from the time from today, tomorrow, I don't know when you're hearing this, but we're days within revisiting a reform to Section 02. And because you didn't ask for it, I may talk a little bit about some of the stuff I've been working on, specifically around AI. I have been neck deep in AI for the last several months. When I say neck deep, I mean I've kind of been using AI for the last couple of years and experimenting with different things. But specifically, in the last probably 3 or 4 months, I've been really deep in the OpenClaw and Hermes and Claude Code and a lot of different things. So I'll kind of be talking a little bit about that because I want to basically replicate as close as I can some of those abilities within a closed environment, meaning everything running locally, but still having the ability to utilize AI tools. So I'm going to try to cram that all in into this episode. If that sounds good to you, stick around and we'll get right into it. Do you always feel like someone's watching you? Get no privacy? Gotta love a little background music while I pull my notes back up, swapping between applications, Notes Nook, VS Code. I'm all over the place. Whoops, as I hit the wrong sound pad. You know, we just do it live here. I appreciate the really well-produced podcasts that do a lot of editing and cut out a lot of the things, but that's just not my style. It's not how I ever wanted to do this. I wanted to be able to kind of do this as kind of open and long, you know, long format, but just transparent as possible. So you're going to hear the screw ups. I try to mute when I cough. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I hit the mute button in time. So You hear the slip ups. Now, I'm not saying I've never edited anything, but generally speaking, I try to do all the editing on board as I'm recording. So, anyway, I'm going to get into some of the housekeeping. I want to give thanks to the people that support the podcast and the community. We are a no advertising, no affiliate link, no BS podcast. So we don't take money from anybody but individuals. So I'm just going to take a quick moment to thank those individuals, starting with our Patreon supporters, Michael Bates, David, TK, Trying, VO, Mr. Milk Mustache, Hutch, Inferno Potato, all coming through the Patreon support. Super, super appreciative. And thank you very much for showing that love to me. Top Lightning Boosters. These are people donating Lightning over the Lightning Network, Bitcoin, Satoshis, those sweet, sweet sats. Bon, always just really sending love to a brother, man. I appreciate it. 2,345 sats on episode 55. Firefly Go. 3,361 sats. Thank you very much. Much, much appreciated. I did set up XMR chat. I have received emails and DMs and messages. Simon, I want to donate, but I don't want to donate with a credit card or this and that and the other. I don't have privacy.com. Totally understand. And, you know, it just takes time for me to figure out what to do and how to solution that. So I set up an XMR chat profile, which I plan to also use, maybe doing some streaming down the road. And so that allows you to basically make donations or tips and using different cryptocurrencies. So the XMR chat that I received was from Privacy Nerd, and the message was, "Finally, bro, appreciate what you do. Keep it up and stay weird. Cheers. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And it does seem like this was a good idea after all. So I have the links for all of that up over at the website. If you go to closednetwork.io, there is a page. I'm actually pulling it up because I can't remember. Oh, yeah, just a support page. And under that support page, I have links to the XMR chat support, as well as Patreon. You can also subscribe directly through the website. You do not have to pay if you can't, so that's okay. Don't not go, because you can sign up for our newsletter. And I'm pushing out more articles. I actually put out an article 2 days ago on the privacy comparison with different health trackers, like apps and hardware, between Garmin and Poros and Runa and Strava and Apple. And so I didn't blast that out in an email, but I'll probably do an email newsletter this week, and I'll have a link to that article. But I'm putting up articles and I'm putting up things. I've been roasted for some stuff here and there, but yeah, I'm writing again. So if you do want to contribute with cryptocurrency, even though it's XMR chat, you can actually donate in Bitcoin, Tether, Litecoin, that sweet, sweet Monero, as well as USDC. I don't know how that works, but okay. But anyway, there's a myriad of different cryptocurrency options where you can put in a name. You can make one up. You don't have to give any other information. You can enter an amount as little as 4 cents, I think, is the minimum. And as much as, you know, a half a million is cool. And then put in a message. And whether or not you want it to be private, I really appreciate the donations. And so I do like to give credit to those donations. So if you don't want me to read it, let me know. Or if you don't want me to say your name, let me know. Totally respect that. So yeah, with the website, I've been kind of reworking things. I'm running on Ghost now, which is a content management system that allows me to do the website and email and some mini pods and articles all in one platform, in addition to direct subscribing for those that want to contribute and don't want to use Patreon. So you can actually just, you know, donate through there on a subscription if you want. And if you can't donate, that's totally cool. You can also just subscribe to the newsletter, and that way when I send them out, you'll get notified of anything. And if you get anything from me, it's just stuff that I've written, or it's podcast stuff. It's not, you know, I don't want to spam anyone, and everything's opt-in. So it's just for the content. It's for information. It's to stay informed. Yeah, it's to help promote the show and everything as well, but there's never any shenanigans in there. So feel free to check that out. Like I said, it's free. Closenetwork.io. You can pop on over and check out all the different links. I also have a links section set up over there for all the community links to our Matrix channel, off-topic channel, as well as our forum. And then also, if you click on the About page, you can reach out to me. So you can either shoot me an email, you can hit me up on SimpleX or on Signal, and I can get you into some of those private groups if you like. The Matrix, like I said, the Matrix links are public, and you can sign up for that. So I want to give a big shout out and thank you to our moderators on Intelligent 7, as well as Maddest Max, helping me behind the scenes, helping welcome new people and kind of moderate at least the Matrix chat. We can't moderate every single space. We try. Most people are cool 99.8% of the time. There are times when people are not cool. And, you know, I appreciate discourse. I like using critical thinking skills and challenging each other, but also, you know, be cool. Like, just don't be a jerk, really, and things will be all right. So they've been helping me with that and for a very long, very long time. And so I always want to say thank you to them. You can also follow me on Mastodon, Noster, X, or Instagram. And I'm getting a little feedback. I think it's my headphones. I think it's my headset. And so, yeah, all the links will be in the show notes or on the website, whatever. And yeah, I'm going to get right into it. So one of the first topics, one of the really kind of big ones that came out was actually, I think it came out, it was proposed. What is this weird feedback? What is this weird feedback going on? I think it's my microphone. Maybe it's my cable. Hopefully that doesn't come through. So HR 8250 is to require operating system providers to verify the age of any user of an operating system and for other purposes. I read, this is only two pages. It's a two-page doc. And it, when it first hit the congress.gov website, the text wasn't even there for the bill. It was just like stubbed out. And then it was introduced on April 13th, but the language wasn't actually up until just a few days ago. And I'm actually going to read just a couple sections of it because this looks like some AI slop if I've ever seen it. And it's just really short, simple. It's vague and very confusing. So the important part is section two requiring, this is a U.S. federal bill that's being proposed in the House of Representatives. So section two starts off with requirements is an operating system provider with respect to any operating system of such provider shall carry out the following. One, require any user of the operating system to provide the date of birth of the user in order to A, set up an account on their operating system, and B, to use the operating system. Section two, if the relevant user of the operating system is under 18 years of age, it requires a parent or legal guardian of the user to verify the date of birth of the user. So strange. So it does say that it's just that they need to enter their age, I guess. I'm not really this bill is very vague. Three, develop a system to allow an app developer to access any information as is necessary collected by the operating system to carry out this section and any regulation promulgated under this section to verify the date of the birth of a user of an app of the app developer. Like, this is written really wonky. To verify the date of birth of a user of an app of the app developer. Okay, and then B is the safe harbor. An operating system provider may not be held liable for a violation of a provision of this act or a regulation promulgated under this act if the provider follows the requirements described in such provision or regulation. What? Like, it's just, and then it goes on into the unfair deceptive acts, practices, power of commission. And then it later just describes what an app is, what an app developer is. The term app developer means a person that owns or controls an app that is available for use in the United States. So I went and copied this and went to an AI detector, and it did say it was a 50% chance that, or at least 50% of it was potentially written by AI. 24 of 50 sentences are likely AI generated, it says. Now, who's to know for sure? I'm just using one that says trusted by Forbes and Business Insider and Yahoo and whatever. Who really knows? But it was just so poorly written that it reminded me of someone like when you're in high school or college and you have a paper to write and it's due at 8 and you woke up at 6 a.m. and realize that you haven't written it yet. This is just really just slop, just slop. So that kind of, the fact that this is just literally being called in is a little concerning. So, you know, this is proposed, obviously. It's not going to be, I'm sure this will be in the, well, maybe not in the news, but I'm sure this was expected, if anything else. And we've been talking about age verification for quite some time now, as it's been happening in other countries, and it's happening or already implemented in certain states in the United States. But now this is a federal proposal. So that, like I said, we're kind of expecting that, I guess. I mean, it's kind of the natural progression of things where we go from here. So I'm just, like I said, there's not a whole lot of information other than just, you know, this is the bill and it's crap. And so, yeah, I don't really know where to go. And it was sponsored by Representative Josh Gottheimer. He's a Democrat out of New Jersey 5th District. And it was also co-sponsored. I'm actually trying to find the co-sponsor because it was co-sponsored with bipartisan support. I'm looking that up. Yes, it was by Elisa M. Stefanik, who is a Republican and the 21st District out of New York. So, you know, these things do generally try to come with bipartisan support to make it look and sound like it's great. The other name for this bill, if you're keeping your ears and eyes open to any news or anything about this, is referred to as the Parents Decide Act. It says this act may be cited as the Parents Decide Act, which is, again, super slop to me. It doesn't mean anything, doesn't describe anything. And it's this bill, if this were to be passed and implemented, would put the onus on operating system providers to have systems in place to, you know, have the birthday as a requirement when setting up an account. What's interesting is I don't see anything in this bill, and I'm sure this might be amended or edited or whatever as it goes through committee, but it doesn't really define what system or if there's any kind of ID. It just says if the relevant user of the operating system is under 18 years of age, it requires a parent. So is this just on the honor system? It could be, because maybe this is the slow drip. We start off with something very palatable, and then we move into things that are, you know, more dystopian, where you'd have to be required to upload an ID. I've been seeing pictures or screenshots posted on X over the last few days of people trying to create Facebook accounts, and they're actually posting the screenshot of it asking them to do a video chat where it can scan their face and their ID to use their platform. And obviously, most people are saying, like, nah, I'm not doing this. And on that, I wanted to talk about this Brussels age app that got hacked in literally 2 minutes. So, because it kind of goes in line with this, right? These tools that are being implemented, these systems being implemented to verify age are haphazardly put together. And this tool that the European Union, there we go, has been promising this tool for over a year. And I feel like someone probably vibe coded this like in the last minute. And the tool that's supposed to let websites and app stores and online services verify that you're over 18 or over 13, over 16, depending upon the jurisdiction, without handing over like your passport or trying to identify to a government database, all while air quotes protecting your privacy, because they always say that. So this individual, Von der Leysen, said the app was technically ready from the European Commission. And within hours of that press event, and I mean hours, a UK-based security researcher named Paul Moore published a bypass of the entire system. So it took 2 minutes from start to finish. And here's what we need to understand about the bypass. He didn't write an exploit. He didn't reverse engineer the code. He didn't find a zero day in the cryptography. He didn't need to. So what he did was, on an Android device running the app, he opened a folder, a plain normal folder called shared_prefs. And that's where Android apps store local settings inside that folder. And there was a file called eudi-wallet.xml. So he opened it, and he detected an encrypted entries that stored his PIN. So he saved the file and restarted the app. And then the app, you know, finding no existing PIN, let him set a brand new one while still preserving the original age verified credential that was, you know, supposed to be locked behind that PIN. And that was it. That's the whole attack. I mean, that's how simple that whole thing was. So now he's carrying a verified adult identity on his phone using a PIN nobody had ever issued to him. Because the whole point is, right, you do the verification if you're the guardian, and you create a PIN that says, that kind of locks that phone within to that age bracket, because, you know, these things are supposed to be into different signal brackets using and signaling to apps what age the individuals in, whether it's under 13, under 16, over 18, so on and so forth. So he just bypassed that and created a new pin. And it didn't take but a couple of minutes and just a little bit of snooping. So it wasn't like some crazy, you know, hacking situation. And this is the level that we're talking about. When we have these bodies of government making these wild decisions and then promising the technology, and then the technology finally gets there and it's circumvented by someone who literally just made a copy and moved the file out and restarted the app. It's like, this is supposed to, right? Again, this is supposed to keep, I'm using air quotes, my fingers, you can't see it because this is an audio podcast, but keep the children safe. But any kid with a little bit of knowledge, know-how of tinkering with stuff could bypass that instantly. And now this whole thing is circumvented. So of course it'll probably be fixed, but I mean, we're talking about, they're using like the lowest level of effort to build these apps. My point is, you can't trust any of this stuff. We can't trust big commercial apps and big commercial software. They get hacked and breached all the time. And they have some of the best state-of-the-art like security teams and audits and all sorts of stuff, and everything is just going to get hacked. So if we're forced into a funnel where you have to dox yourself just to use an operating system, even if it's ephemeral, I mean, because this would apply to any operating system, you know, then it creates this huge problem, because it's like, our identity and our personal information is the one thing that we're all trying to kind of keep very close to our chest. If you're playing poker, if you ever watch people play poker professionally, they keep their cards on the table and they flip up the corners just ever so slightly, just so only they can see it, right? Because they don't want to show what they've got. And that's kind of what we do with our names and our addresses and phone numbers and social security, or you know, all the ID numbers that governments issue to us, as well as other banking info and all this other stuff. We try to keep it secure and we control the access. And when they force us to have to give that up, and it's so loosely managed and so loosely stored, it is a great concern for everybody. And so other researchers dug in after more, and the findings pretty much got worse from there. So independent developers found that biometric templates like your face, your fingerprint, the actual measurements of the app, like the app uses to recognize you, were stored on device in a way that could be exposed. Other researchers demonstrated bypasses of the app's biometric authentication entirely. And there were serious questions about the cryptographic wrapping of the credentials. And so the European Commission's response is, suddenly the app wasn't technically ready anymore. Now it was, quote, still in demonstration stage. And, air quote, a new version is being prepared to address the issues. So I want to kind of zoom out here for a second. In March, so just 5 weeks ago, more than 400 privacy and security experts signed an open letter. 400. That letter asked the EU to pause the rollout of age verification technology until the scientific community could agree on whether the tech even works. Okay? So these are big deals. When you get 400 professionals from the scientific community that basically say, like, hey, we have concerns. Obviously, you want to do what you want to do with your laws, but we'd really like you to pump the brakes so that this technology can be proved first, or at least we can agree, we can get a consensus on how this tech works and if it's safe, essentially. And Brussels ignored all of them. And here we are a month later. That was 5 weeks ago, okay? So three things I want to leave with you in this story. One is, age verification is a manufactured problem attached to a surveillance solution. The EU did not need a pan-European digital identity wallet to stop 12-year-olds from watching porn. I mean, that's just, it's just, this isn't the move, okay? So operating systems already ship with parental controls. And I've talked about this many times before. Both iOS from Apple, Google's Android have really great parental controls. It doesn't mean it's impossible to circumvent, but I mean, they're very hard. You got to have some smart kids. And if those kids can circumvent, they probably earn the right to go onto the dark web, right? So, it's always like protect the kids and keep them off porn and OnlyFans or whatever. And I'm not against the morality of it. I'm not against the ethic, desire to keep kids from seeing stuff and interacting with potentially unsafe people and those kinds of things. But this is not the way we go about it. So every major browser has a safe search mode. And what the EU does, what do they need the wallet for? I don't know. And what will they use it for in the instant the political winds shift, right? Is everything else they plan to like bolt onto it? Like is everything else they plan to do with this system like just bolt right onto it and tap into that? Does that mean online speech, copyright enforcement, subscriber identification, protest attribution? Like you're building a surveillance pipeline, not a porn filter. And these things are serious because, you know, it starts off with, well, we just want to check your age. We just want to check your age so we can make sure that you don't go see things that you shouldn't do. But that's the beginning of it. And then from there, it's like, oh, okay, any other law they pass and says, well, we don't want you to say mean things to people. And so we're also going to have to dox you on anything that you can talk to people on. We also need to know who you're talking to. You know, just it keeps going and going and going. So two, the zero knowledge proof is doing a lot of marketing work lately. So every age verification pitch comes with the same line. Don't worry, it's zero knowledge. We don't store your identity. And then you look at the actual implementation and you find unencrypted biometric templates in a shared preferences folder any user can edit. So if your threat model is a sophisticated nation state attacker, maybe the math doesn't hold up. So if your threat model is a bored teenager with with developer options turned on, then the math is irrelevant is kind of what I'm saying. So the third thing, and this is, you know, minimum viable product that's being shipped and it's already failed. So whatever ships next will be more locked down, more closed source, more tied to hardware attestation. And at this point, like every time the system gets broken in public, the political answer is like, not maybe we shouldn't do this, but the political answer is always like, oh, well, the next version, more surveillance, like, you know, it's coming, we'll fix that. And, you know, you think this is a European problem, uniquely EU story that doesn't touch the United States, but let me introduce you to that bill again, right, that we just dropped, because that thing looks like it was written in the middle of the night when someone came home from the bar and realized, oh my God, I was supposed to write this stupid bill and let me fire up ChatGPT or Claude and crank something out real quick because it's just god awful. So I kind of went into that whole 8250 and I'm kind of just out of my normal notes flow. So bear with me because I actually had a lot more I wanted to say about that. But I think, really, until we get more information, you know, we don't know. And really, at the end of this, if you're in the United States, this is just a call to action. Call your representative about this, like this week. This is not a partisan issue. This is a device freedom issue. So if you care about open source, if you care about things like FDroid, if you care about sideloading, and I hate that term sideloading, but it's kind of what the term means, being able to install apps outside of the app store. If you care about running a phone without Google or an Apple account, you know, this is important. If you want to run Linux, if you want to run, I mean, think of how many ephemeral operating systems there are specifically just to protect your privacy and that are highly secure, like CubesOS, like TailsOS, like Hunix. These operating systems are designed to be used in the moment and then forgotten. Actually, I was reading an article, and I don't have it in my show notes, but that Tor is actually reading. They're working on releasing a memory only, RAM only stored state for server operators. So basically, what that means is typically if somebody gets raided or whatever, and they take the servers and they unplug them, right? The data is on the hard drives. But in this case, if the servers shut down, like it just does a memory dump out of the RAM, and everything, all the traffic logs and all that kind of stuff will be stored in memory as opposed to stored disk. So that's kind of cool. And I know there's a lot of, well, you know, Tor is a CIA op or a Fed op, and, you know, it very well may be, but it, at least there are efforts being made to try to minimize the potential data that could be extracted or exfiltrated from these servers in the event that they're basically seized. So these are the things why we need to call our representatives and say that you care about, you know, about this, that you need to push back on this, like right now, just, you know, push back. And the EFF has some really good information on their website to, like, if you don't know who your representative is, you don't know who your senator is and how to contact them, you can go to the EFF.org and you can actually generate your correspondence. I like to actually send them without using those. I use my own subject lines. I put in my own text because I want it. I know that, you know, anything helps, but I think it helps even more if you are more sincere about your position on the issue. So do that. Do that, like, as soon as you can. It literally takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You can do it while you're going to the bathroom, right? I mean, get off the doom scroll, get off off the news site, and send your representative an email saying, like, hey, you know, I'm not down for this Parents Decide Act, this HR 8250. Please don't vote this way. This is not good for us. And also, too, like, who the hell is writing this? So, anyways, in the topic of surveillance, I'm going to go into the Meta's name tag glasses plus the Palantir and DHS and ICE stuff. So this is kind of two stories, but I want to pair them together because I think they're two halves of the same coin. So you have the private sector surveillance creeping toward public identification, and you have public sector surveillance already deployed and operating. So we're going to start with Meta. And the New York Times published an article this month citing an internal Meta memo that describes a feature being developed for the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses. Inside the company, the feature is called, and I'm not making this up, name tag. So here's how a name tag works. This is according to the New York Times reporting. It says you're wearing the glasses, you look at a person, the glasses run facial recognition against a database. Meta AI tells you who that person is, their name, their LinkedIn, public records, any prior interaction you've had with them, apparently, all while you're just looking at them. Is that not creepy or what? How creepy is that? So more than 70 civil society and advocacy organizations have signed an open letter to Meta demanding the company abandon the name tag feature entirely. The coalition is not a fringe group. It includes ACLU, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Fight for the Future, Access Now, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. So their central argument is simple, and, you know, bystanders cannot consent, right? So there's this whole thing, especially in the United States, where you have public domain, but public domain is generally, like, you know, if someone's taking a photograph and you're in the background, there's nothing really you can do about it. If they and you are both in a public place, or even if they're in a public place, like on a sidewalk, there's people who call themselves like auditors or something, and they do this like at police stations or different things. And, you know, I'm all for, like, freedom of speech. I'm also just kind of like, don't be an asshole kind of a thing, but whatever. I mean, there's absolutists for everything. But in this case, there's a difference between just someone taking a photo and you happen to be in the background, or someone taking a video and, you know, you are doing something in the background, especially in a public place, versus an individual wearing something that's basically doing facial recognition on you and pulling up. Right now, it seems to be this whole, you know, like, identification, identify who you are based upon whatever is in the database, if there's any information about you there, and then also tying in any connections to the person that's wearing the glasses. Super dystopian. Because think about that. What's the next step, you know, is, think if you're a stalker and you know, there's a creepy dude who's got these on and hanging around, you know, places where there's women and stuff like, I don't know. I just feel like that would be like a real, or bars, right? Things like that. Think of, you know, I'm thinking about these scenarios where, you know, it could be someone in a bar and someone's drinking and they're wearing the glasses and they can like identify who they are really quickly and make it sound like they've known each other before and, you know, establish some sort of familiarity to take advantage of that person. I mean, there's just nothing good that can come from this at all. Like there's just nothing good. So, you know, I'm looking at this like just mostly from the stalkerware, right? Abusive ex can find former partners in a crowd or whatever. So an ICE agent in plain clothes can identify protesters. A federal officer can identify journalists meeting with sources. A debt collector could identify you outside your apartment or your home. And none of those people need a warrant, a subpoena, a badge, or a reason. Just have the technology. So the coalition's letter says, and I quote, "The dangers posed by this feature cannot be resolved through product design changes, opt-out mechanisms, or incremental safeguards." And I agree. And Meta's response to all of this was, and I'm paraphrasing, "We do not currently offer facial recognition on our smart glasses. If we were to release such a feature, we would take a very thoughtful approach." Take a thoughtful approach. Meta's the company that tries to get, when you install the app on your phone, one of the first things it does is like, oh, upload your contacts so we can try to connect you with people you know. Every photo gets facial scanned and, you know, auto tagged and all that stuff. Even if you don't have a Facebook profile, if you were in a situation where someone took a group photo or took a selfie or whatever and they posted that on there, you have a profile. You may not have an account, but you have a shadow profile. And, you know, so if you say like, oh, well, I'm not on any of these social networks, no one's going to recognize me. I don't have LinkedIn. I don't have Facebook. Doesn't matter. They will be able to identify you because all it takes is one association of one piece of data linked to you in order to do that. So if that person uploaded, you know, the contacts and they have a phone number and somehow in any way something gets tagged to you, you have a profile. And it starts increasing the accuracy even though you don't have an account there. So that's kind of freaky. And then, you know, the other shoe dropping, right? Because while Meta is telling advocacy groups that they don't currently, you know, process your video with any kind of like human review, and reporting from like Swedish newspapers like, I think it was Svenska. I'm going to totally screw this up. Svenska Dagblad. Dagbladet. I know there are people out there laughing at me, and that's totally deserved. And Göteborgs Posten last month showed their contractors in Kenya were reviewing personal videos recorded by Meta smart glass users, including intimate footage. So the whole "we don't have like humans watching you" promise, it's already broken. And, you know, "we don't currently offer facial recognition" is the same kind of phrasing currently. So I don't know. My take is the hardware is like probably already deployed. And so the machine learning models probably just missing piece. So that pretending name tag is like a hypothetical, is like pretending like a loaded gun. You're not currently pointing it at somebody and it's unloaded, but the gun is loaded. And the pointing is a policy decision, not like a technical one, right? Because they have the technology, right? And they have AI models and they have the infrastructure. And if you're a journalist, an activist, and an abuse survivor, someone with a stalker, someone whose physical safety depends on like not being recognized in public, your threat model changed the day those glasses went on sale. And you can't tell who's wearing these things. Like they have this indicator LED, this tiny light, but most people can't see it in daylight. And there's even people like online that will like, you can send these to, and for like, you know, couple hundred bucks or whatever, they like will take it apart and remove the light, which is even more freaky, but whatever. Light is not something hard to disable on something like that. I'm sure it's, you know, the whole concept is like, well, if you see someone wearing them and the light's on, you know they're recording. But that, what does that do though? Are you gonna duck? Are you gonna hide? I mean, you know, it's like, it's just weird. So that's the corporate side. right? So I'm going to talk about the government side. So on April 17th, just a couple days, 3 days ago, from this recording at least, U.S. Representatives Dan Goldman and Nydia Valquez, along with Senator Ron Wyden and Representative John Garamendi, led a group of 30 lawmakers in sending a formal letter to the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement, that's ICE, and Customs and Border Protection. And the letter demands answers about Palantir-developed surveillance tools being used by those agencies. They sent, like, the, you know, they sent, I think their response deadline is April 24th. So that's this week on Friday. I'd be interested to see what comes of that. But what they're asking for is they want a full inventory of every database, every analytics program, every application that DHS, ICE, or CBP uses for immigration enforcement. And they want to know which ones were built or are maintained by Palantir, which ones were built by other private contractors, what the data retention policies are, vendor contracts, and this is a big one, specific details about facial recognition use during immigration enforcement, including documented false positives and mistaken identifications. So the letter is trying to force visibility into what reporting has already started to surface, which is DHS and ICE have built out surveillance, a surveillance stack that goes far beyond Palantir. Reporting indicates Palantir's analytics platform, like Think Gotham, Think Foundry. Then you have Clearview AI for facial recognition. This is the stack. PenLink for social media monitoring. L3Harris for cell site simulators. These are also known as stingrays. Man-in-the-middle attacks, the known as, you know, all these different phrases, which pretend to basically be a cell phone tower and scoop up all the phones within range. And then also Paragon Solutions for the mobile spyware side. So, you know, using all of these technologies together, that's basically the entire surveillance apparatus. So it's not a single tool. It's a combination of tools, and they're trying to find out, like, how far all of this goes. Palantir responded this week with what can be described as a 22-point manifesto, which I thought was funny because I played the manifesto at the beginning of the podcast. So defending their government contracts, and I'll leave you to read, you know, the rest in the show notes because there's links to all of this. But I put these two stories side by side so you can kind of see the pipeline end to end. So the glasses do the identification, the databases do the correlation, the enforcement does basically everything else with their apparatus. So, you know, again, what should we do? So we have April 24th, the response, you know, deadline. I'm going to try to follow that and see if I can get any information from there. Hopefully I can, and kind of report back on that. And beyond the 702, you know, call, going to ask to, you know, call your representatives, call your senators, tell them to support Goldman, Wyden, Valquez, right? Tell them that you want transparency on their surveillance stack. EFF, Epic, and Fight for the Future are all running action campaigns on this right now. So I'll have links in the show notes, and you can go and kind of dive a little bit deeper and, again, find out, use those resources and find out how you can get engaged, how you can get involved. I know this particular episode is very U.S. focused. Oftentimes I try to be much more global, but this was a lot that's kind of happened in the last few weeks and even this week. So kind of really just wanted to condense this into like a plan of action, because I was actually talking to my brother about this on Saturday. Was, you know, he was telling me, oh yeah, I listened to the last couple episodes, really enjoyed them. And I said, where I'm struggling with, and I've kind of joked about it, right? You know, we drink and we self-medicate to kind of keep ourselves, you know, kind of numb to all the different things that are going on. And I was like, you know, the nature of what I do and the research that I do, it's hard sometimes to not get pulled into this kind of depressive state, because you're like, oh my gosh, like, we're going to lose on every front. We can't even have like a Linux operating system, can't even use a phone, like a de-Googled phone. Like they want to make it as difficult as possible for any of us to use technology where we're not having to like expose our identity. And I said, you know, it's just kind of like hard. And I'll be completely honest. I mean, there are times where I just have to take a break from doing a show, not because I love doing it. I love research. I have so much data that never makes it to the podcast. And that's why I'm also doing the website and the articles, because I go into detail there. Like the most recent one, and I know I'm tangenting, but I need to explain like the mental process, you know, that I'm kind of going through. So I did an article called Who Really Sells Your Fitness Data? You know, a verbatim read of 5 privacy policies that I read, every single one. And it's a 15-minute read or so, 10 or 15 minutes, depends on your speed. But I really broke everything down by, you know, who's using your data to train AI. How's your data stored? Is it in encrypted? Is it encrypted at rest? Like, what's the advertising policy? What's their third party policies? And so, you know, I love to deep dive and get that information. Unfortunately, it's just so much information. I can't put it all on a podcast. That wouldn't be like 4 hours long every week. And I just don't have the fortitude for that, because it's a lot of information. But I kind of try to condense things down into the highlights. And so that way, people where it affects you can kind of go, oh, wake up call, like this is happening and I need to do something about it. Because if we just sit there and we just, you know, rant about it online, it doesn't change anything. We really need to be proactive and working with our local and state government and our federal government to combat this and speak out. I mean, they are the representatives of the people and we need to be communicating with them. So anyways, I think we kind of get the point. And I'm going to kind of shift to who's watching you out there and, to what your own device might be doing behind like your back, because the FBI just demonstrated something in federal court that every Signal user on an iPhone like really needs to know. And this comes to with like a 30-second fix, that you can do. You can do it during, while you're listening to this. So here's the breakdown. The FBI recovered deleted Signal messages from a suspect's phone. So even though Signal had been completely uninstalled from the device, and they did this without breaking encryption. So suspect's device removed Signal, and like it's not even uninstalled on the phone. So they used something like pretty mundane, which is the notifications database. And this is specific to iPhones, okay? So this was first reported by Joseph Cox at 404 Media, and I actually listened to his podcast on it. I was like, what? What's going on with this? And basically, that just highlights the friction between like secure messaging apps and the operating systems they run on. So there's the case. There's a federal terrorism case in Texas in July of last year, 2025. A group of people allegedly attacked, I say allegedly because, you know, I know there's video footage, but I'm going to say allegedly, that attacked like the ICE Prairie Land detention facility in Alvarado, Texas. And they set off fireworks and vandalized property. And one of them allegedly shot a police officer in the neck. So it became the first prosecution of alleged Antifa-linked activity after the Trump administration's 2025 domestic terror designation of Antifa. So one of the defendants, Lynette Sharp, a 57-year-old cooperating witness who had pled guilty to providing material support to terrorists, had her iPhone seized by the FBI. And on March 10th, 2026, so like a month ago, a little over a month ago, during the 12th day of the federal trial, the FBI Special Agent Clark Whitehorn took the stand and described something that basically made everyone go like, what? He explained that the Bureau had forensically extracted copies of incoming Signal messages from Sharp's iPhone, messages that had been set to disappear from the app, from the Signal app that was even deleted. So it's all documented in Exhibit 15B of the trial. So what actually happened, right? And this is a critical part for everyone listening. Like, lock in. When someone sends you a message on Signal, the Signal servers push a notification to Apple's push notification service, also called APN. That notification is then delivered to your iPhone. If you have notification previews enabled, which iOS does this by default, the actual decrypted text content of that message lands in your iOS notification database. And that database lives locally on the device. It's not in the cloud. But the problem is iOS retains that notification data for approximately 30 days. It persists even if you delete the message inside Signal. It persists even if you have disappearing messages turned on and the message is already vanished. It's still there even if you uninstall Signal entirely. So the notification content has already been copied to a completely separate part of the operating system, and Signal has no control over that, right? So when the FBI forensically imaged Sharp's iPhones, they were able to pull incoming Signal messages right out of the notification database. So no encryption was broken, no Signal backdoor, just a copy of the decrypted preview iOS had basically stored privately, or quietly, I should say, because it didn't really inform the user, like, hey, by the way, this message is going to be stored on your phone for 30 days, regardless of what you do. So what are the technical points we want to take away from this? So only incoming messages were recovered. Outgoing messages are not stored in the notification database, right? So that's the first point. Two is Signal's end-to-end encryption was not broken. The message had to be decrypted by the device in order to show a notification preview in the first place. And it already decrypted, and the preview is what, you know, iOS held on to in its database. And the third option is, like, this is not a Signal vulnerability. Signal didn't do anything wrong here. This is an iOS issue that affects any messaging app that shows content and notifications. WhatsApp, Telegram, iMessage, anything. So, you know, and this required physical access to the phone. They did a full forensic image of the device. So this is not a remote attack. But if your threat model includes somebody taking your device, and for journalists, activists, abuse survivors, anyone crossing a border, it absolutely does. This matters. This needs to be top of mind. So, you know, it's just like, the crazy thing is that people in the forensic community have known about this iOS notification behavior, but this is the first that I think a lot of people have heard about it. And so it's almost kind of disheartening, because you're like, wow, no one out there was telling anybody, like, hey, if someone gets physical access to the device and can image it, especially if it's in an after unlock, you know, mode, or they can be compelled to provide, the person being arrested can be compelled to unlock the device with biometrics, so face scan or a thumbprint, versus a PIN number, at least in the United States. But, you know, it's like, even if you have disappearing messages, even if you deleted the app, there's still a record of incoming messages that would have been stored in that notification database. So, I mean, even everyday Signal users just have no idea, right? You set these disappearing messages, and, you know, you think, like, oh, cool, you know, we're all kosher here. Yeah, it's not the case. So think about journalists protecting sources, right? If your phone got seized in an airport, and there was, like, all those off-the-record Signal messages from your source, they might still be sitting in a notification database for up to 30 days. I mean, think about the domestic abuse situation. Like, if someone can gain physical access to the device, and that is the threat model in the majority of abuse cases, the settings you made in Signal don't really matter. The notification database, like, keeps a copy of at least all the incoming travelers crossing the border, right? So phones are searched all the time, and they're increasingly becoming more common. And the legal protections are really kind of, they vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So what to do, right? Here's the practical part. And, you know, pause this episode and go change it right now. They're, you know, it's 30 seconds. So open the Signal app. This is specifically for iPhone users. Open the Signal app, tap settings, tap notifications, tap notification content, and then select no name or content. That's like the nuclear option. Your notifications will say signal message with no preview of who sent it or what they said. If you want like some middle ground, you can choose no content, right? So basically it'll show the sender, right? But it won't actually show any of the message, which, you know, I think that's pretty good, right? And let's be real, like it doesn't take much to just unlock the device and then read the message. Really, you can still get notified that the message was received. And I think that's what most people want. You can also go to settings on the phone itself and go into notifications and then tap the show previews and set it to never, or at a minimum when unlocked, right? So never is the safest option. So when unlocked means previews only appear when you've authenticated with Face ID, or your passcode, but it's not cleanly documented whether that still writes to the notification database. So never is the kind of like the better option, a better approach, in my opinion. So, that's kind of like, you know, and I know, not all of us are on Graphene OS and all that stuff. And on Android devices, from what I understand, there is a temporary cache that is only there, I think, every 12 or 24 hours it's removed from the notifications. And obviously, to a reboot or anything like that would clear that. So it doesn't have that 30-day retention. A couple bonus moves for the really security conscious listeners is consider when you need notifications for Signal at all, just disable them entirely and just check the app manually when you want to. It's like less convenient, but it's a much smaller attack surfaces. And then two, if you're on Graphene OS, and we've covered Graphene OS like security extensively on this podcast, but get just another reason why, you know, using a privacy focused Android solution is they don't use things like Apple's push notifications infrastructure. You have far more control over what gets stored, where, for how long. And, you know, maybe this will help push you towards getting off iOS because, I mean, again, like this, how long has this been going on? Probably forever. You know, and then also to just remember physical security of your device really does matter. So all the encryption in the world doesn't help if somebody can forensically image your unlocked phone. So use a strong passcode, turn off biometric, unlock, right, when you're crossing borders or you're doing anything that puts you in a higher threat level, and just keep the device locked or just off. Because like I said, mostly in the United States, you cannot be compelled to give up a PIN number, but they can compel you for a biometric. So, you know, Signal's encryption is good. Nobody broke it. But it's just one layer of your privacy stack, right? The operating system that your phone runs on, the settings that you've configured, the physical security of your device, all of those matter just as much as the cryptography itself. So check your Signal notifications, go in your settings, and just, you know, it takes a few seconds to just, you know, close that gap. Most people, you know, didn't even know existed until the story broke, myself included. I did not know. So anyway, yeah, it's kind of a, that's kind of a doozy there. I do want to go into this Vercel and context.ai and the supply chain. I just found it kind of interesting, to be honest with you. And it's kind of shifting gears more about like breach, because this is one of the cleanest textbook examples I've seen of what AI tool supply chain risk actually looks like in practice. And if we have enough time, I'm going to talk a little bit about my AI stuff. So on April 19th, which was yesterday, Vercel confirmed a security incident via a bulletin on their knowledge base. Here's what happened. So a Vercel employee installed an app from a company called context.ai. And Context is a third-party AI productivity tool. Now, I don't know exactly what it does, but the details really matter less than the pattern. So the employee connected the Context.ai app to their corporate Google Workspace via OAuth. So they just, you know, that's OAuth is when it means, like, I'm sure you see it, right? Like you go to a website and it's like, oh, would you like to log in with your Google account, right? So anything that contains like the Google account, you can basically log in with that and you know, grant access and or permission to your Google account. So that will give it access to like your email and calendar and Drive and whatever else it wants access to. Well, that context.ai got breached. And the attackers used the OAuth Grant that was sitting in the Contexted AI account to take over the Vercel employees' corporate Google Workspace account. And then from there, they pivoted into Vercel's internal systems. Let me say that part again because I want it to like land. The attacker never touched Vercel. They compromised a third-party AI productivity tool. And because that tool had OAuth permission into a Vercel employee's Google Workspace, the attacker got to walk right into Vercel's internal environment. So what did they get? All right. Some of Vercel's internal systems, like a limited subset of customer credentials, and Vercel has reached out directly to every affected customer and told them to rotate their credentials immediately. They, you know, when they found out, and you know, that part should make every developer and every ops person like listening cringe, right? Environment variables that were not flagged as like sensitive. So the environment variables marked sensitive are stored in separate cryptographic systems that prevent them from being read even by like the hosting environment. And Vercel says that there's no evidence those sensitive variables were accessed, but the ones the developers forgot to flag, those got read. And before I go too far, I don't think I explained what Vercel is. And they're like an AI company. So they do gateways and development stacks and software development kits and basically, you know, workflow and management for software developers. So it's a pretty popular tool set that developers use. So think about, you know, their clients' accounts, the clients that use their tools rely on their infrastructure for their development. And Vercel is it's probably not going to affect everyone, but you know, there's a huge share of like Web3 and on-chain projects built on top of Vercel. So there's a lot of crypto related stuff that could be impacted. I'm sure developers spent an entire weekend like rotating RPC keys, wallet connector tokens, admin dashboards, all that stuff. So like they're heavily used by these companies and these projects and these startups that build out all these tools. So it's kind of a big deal. So the big takeaway is, whether you're a developer or you're an operator or just a normal person, human, trying to, you know, keep your digital life sane, your attack surface is not your just application. Your attack surface is every OAuth connection. You know, not just you, but your team or you personally. So, think about how many times, and I know most of the people that listen to the podcast probably have very strict or have more strict practices for creating accounts. But a lot of people will click continue with Google or log in with Google or log in with Apple. Some people use Facebook login, or even X. I mean, I understand that sometimes it's more convenient to do that than it is to set up an account, create a unique email address, create a unique password when you can just, I'll just sign in with my Google account. But this kind of made me go like, I wonder, you know, how many times I've done that over the last couple of years and maybe forgot. So this is just another call to action, like a good hygiene thing to do. It's just if you have a Google account or you use a Google account, is to go to your account permissions page and just look at what you've granted access to and revoke anything that you don't actively use. And like do this regularly, like put it on your calendar to go once every month or two and just go look. It's kind of like just like a thing that I think people like, or, you know, I know, again, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably don't really use Google logins or Apple login with Apple and stuff, but you probably have family members and friends who do. And this is like a good thing, right? This is a good hygiene to just say like, hey, you know, I heard about this story. This employee at Vercel used some AI tool and logged in with his Google Workspace account and it was compromised and this became very problematic. So like, it's good to just check and see what has access to your Google account that you have authenticated, or you know, talking to your friends, talking to your family, and also with Apple and also with Facebook, like, you know, because these single sign-ons or these, they, you know, you probably also have seen it at some point where it's like, oh, create a passkey with us. Well, what they're trying to do is lock you into their platform of authentication for your passkey, which is basically like, hey, if you log into this account, go to your other device where you're also there, and just that's the passkey is basically, it's like a multi-factor authentication. And, you know, I'm not against multi-factor authentication. I think it's a very good thing, but I think it's good if you're in control of it, because there's another thing that happens too, and it doesn't happen very often, but if that service provider were to go down or go away, or there was a problem or a cyber attack or something, it could actually keep you from being able to log in important systems if you are relying on a third-party provider to actually authenticate you into that system. And if you create an account using the Google account or something like that, it basically doesn't, there's no other way to log in. You have to use that method every time you want to log into it. So this was just kind of like an anecdotal story for me to kind of bring that up and check on some hygiene. On the last episode, I talked about the YouTuber who downloaded their data from Google. It was like 527 gigabytes, called, you know, Google Takeout. You can download everything. And just the amount of information that they stored on this individual was just nutty, right? And so it's good to just also like go through your password manager, go through your accounts, see if there's anything stale, see if it's time to delete some old accounts you don't need, that you know, just minimize the attack surfaces, because it's only a matter of time before a site gets breached. I actually found it kind of interesting. I was logging into my work Trello account, which is just a project management tool for keeping track of like projects and, you know, putting tasks in certain people columns and whatever, and adding notes and all that kind of stuff. Just a project management tool. And I use a password manager for literally everything. And in my password manager for this particular vault, I have it with Bitwarden. And Bitwarden had a notice in that entry, in that record for that login, that I should change my password that had been compromised. Like, this is interesting, right? Because I've never been notified by Trello that my credentials, or that they ever had a breach, or that something was compromised. I had to find out from my password manager that it had been compromised. And, you know, is it a big deal? Not really. But still, like, these things can add up, and sometimes it can be a big deal. So on the topic of AI, I just kind of wanted to kind of get personal for a few minutes, because I like talking about the projects I'm working on, whether it's self-hosting or Linux and operating systems and all that fun stuff. And I kind of like also ending with something that's kind of fun and cool. And I don't know, to me, it's cool. I know that a lot of people have a lot of negative thoughts about AI in general, and myself included, in a lot of ways. But I do feel like we've reached this point in time where, as much as we would all love for it to be uninvented, it's not going to go away anytime soon. And especially in the line of work that I'm in, I'm actually being tasked or requested by clients to evaluate different tool sets to streamline some internal processes. And I'll just kind of keep it vague. And so I've been doing that. And I use all the commercial tools for my professional job. Most of it is an evaluation, not implementation. Very, very little of it is implementation, because I just don't trust it. It's, you know, but it is quite good. So these are tools like Claude Code. That's probably the one, the heaviest. But I really was like, you know, if I'm going to learn how to do this stuff, I also want to be able to replicate a lot of these workflows in my own personal life without using third-party commercial proprietary LLMs, large language models. So I've been experimenting with OpenClaw, which is an open source project. If you haven't heard of it, it's quite popular. It's been out for about 6-ish months. I've been using it for about 3, maybe 2.5 to 3, somewhere in there. And I haven't really talked about it because I'm kind of on the fence. Do I talk about AI? But I think it's kind of like so out there that to not talk about it and talk about how you can use it in a way that actually works in a private manner and for your life is a benefit, would be a disservice, especially since I've been using it myself. So my goal is not talking about Claude Code, or which is by Anthropic, or Codex by OpenAI and Google Gemini or Perplexity Computer or any of that kind of stuff. Those that go to YouTube if you're interested in that stuff. Tons of good resources. I want to talk about is an AI assistant that could help me with research, keeping tabs on breaking news and compile that information for me every morning, right? So how can I set this up? But I want to do this in a way where I don't have to rely on Anthropic or OpenAI or Google or any other cloud vendor. So I don't want to use an account. I don't want any telemetry. No, please agree to our new terms, and no data leaving my network for my personal stuff. So here's how I got here. I tested on two machines. So I'm currently using on two different machines. I've got two different OpenClaw instances. So I've got one that's running on a System76 laptop, an Oryx Pro from like 2019. And it's pretty beefy, and it has an NVIDIA GPU in it. So I'm running Ubuntu Server on there. And it's got plenty. It's got 32 gigs of RAM on there. It's like DDR4. And it's doing quite well, actually, running like 7 and 8 billion parameter models. The reason I wanted it on that laptop was because I also might be able to want to take it with me when I travel. And then I also have an Apple Mac Studio with an M1 Max chip and 32 gigs of unified memory. And so it's about a four-year-old machine. I'm just telling you these things because if you want to play around with this stuff, you can kind of like buy this stuff secondhand and for pretty cheap. And it does a good job at running the stack. So I'm using OpenClaw, and then I'm using Ollama for the language models. And these are one command downloads. You just, you know, on Linux, it's pretty easy. On Mac OS, I'm using Homebrew. To install, it's like really easy. And I'm using the Qwen 2.5. I'm using the 7 billion parameter version on my Mac. And I was skeptical of how good it would be. And it's actually shockingly good. And I'm using the Qwen 2.5 model. And I'm also using the 3.1, the 8 billion parameter version. And that's the Meta's Open Weights release. So slightly larger. It's really strong at like natural language tasks, writing, drafting things. It's a little chattier than the Qwen model. The Qwen model is good for just kind of more simple tasks that you want to kick off. The reason why I did OpenClaw was because I wanted to first learn it and understand how to use it, what skills I can create for it and that kind of stuff. And I like interacting with it remotely. So I do have it set up with a Telegram channel. I know, right, bar of Telegram, but it's pretty benign to me because I'm only using it for the bot communication. And I've just been really kind of impressed with how these models can work in a local environment having weird stuff. Like I've got a pretty expansive server of files with MP3s and WAV and FLAC and stuff, and having it kind of like help me organize stuff and look at it and just index things and putting stuff into spreadsheets and looking at internal docs. And I don't have a problem like running any of that stuff because it's not uploading anything. Nothing's going to the cloud. Nothing's going anywhere. And so it's just kind of like a really cool helper tool. And I don't know how far I'm going to go with all of that. Obviously, there's some limitations with the model sizes, but this was it could be a fun weekend project. Is to set up Linux, install Linux on a fresh. Also, caveat, I have these on systems that have no personal data on them. So the only personal data I'm having it do anything with is personal data I'm physically, or not, you know, physically, but I'm like copying to it, or I'm putting it, or you know, where it has access to it locally. And I think it's important because it's just good. It's good, like best practice to put these on things that don't have like all your personal stuff on it. So it does, I would set this up on a completely separate system. And you can do things like I saw a video by some ordinary gamer today that gave me a really good idea because he set up CirxNG in a Docker and then just connected it so it does web searches for him. That I'm actually using the Brave API on mine because I wanted this thing to be able to go to the web because I basically created my own dashboard. I recreated my own Google Reader. I have not found a great RSS reader, and there might be some good ones out there. Let me know because I want to know what you guys are using. But I just want to be able to compile. I have curated lists on Mastodon and X and news sites that I basically got bookmarked. And I was like, man, I just really want an easy way to bring all the information to me and categorize it, whether it's like privacy or security or data breach. So I wanted my own dashboard that I could go, oh, this is interesting, and go read about it. Is this something that would be good for the podcast? Is this just good information? Is this something I should share online? So it's, I'm keeping it very niche in that area, and it's been awesome. And it sends me a message on Telegram at 10 a.m. My bot does, and tells me like, hey, this is all the information I compiled. I can access the, you know, information from there. It can generate it as a doc or a PDF for me to download, and it has all the links inside, or I can just go look at the dashboard, and it vibe coded the whole dashboard. So, it's not super great because I'm using that one with the local LLM. I have had much better success using bigger, models, the commercial pay for models on, specifically Claude. So if it's something that you're thinking about for like work, I'd definitely lean that way. But if it's for personal projects, weekend warrior projects, this might be something to check out. And it kind of it puts you in the know about AI, because these are skills that I think that like if you are under the age of probably 50, maybe even 55, I don't know. I feel like it's important to at least understand what it is, how it works, what it can be used for. I'm not saying use it for your assistant. I'm just saying it's good to think outside the box and try to come up with a solution for something and try to build it. There's so many resources online, tons of resources, great YouTube videos, stuff like that. So anyway, if it's not your cup of tea, I totally get it. But I also think that like it's worth mentioning because it's something that I'm self-hosting. It's something that I can run locally. It's something that I can use it in a private manner. And it works pretty dang well. These models sucked like just even 3 to 6 months ago, and they're getting much, much better, at least, you know, for the things that I'm using it for. So anyway, that's it. That's everything I'll say about AI for now. Because I don't know, I've been having a lot of fun with it, and it's kind of cool to have fun with something all my other research is leading me to things that are just not fun or exciting because they're just stripping our humanity and our sovereignty away. But I do want to talk about something that's important, which is the Section 702. So on April 17th of this year, 3 days ago, the United States Congress passed a 10-day clean extension of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Not a reauthorization, an extension. So the clock runs out on April 30th. So let me explain like what this is and what the most important things are in 702, you know, their history and why your phone call matters. Like, again, call to action. I have a lot of actions for things for you guys to do this week. I'm doing them. I need you to do them with me too, right? But I want to explain why this matters. So quick primer in case you need a refresher. So Section 702 of FISA, right, is the law that lets U.S. intelligence community conduct mass surveillance of non-U.S. persons located outside the United States without a warrant. That's the design. That's what it's supposed to do. Well, the problem is, the very, very well-documented problem, is that Americans' communications routinely get swept in that collection. And the FBI has been querying that data for years without a warrant, often in ways that has been found over and over again to be improper or outright abusive. So the FISA court itself has flagged this repeatedly, and reformers have been trying to fix this for a very long time. And every time leadership slides through a clean reauthorization, the reformers get pushed aside and just cycle just continues, right? But this time it's a little different. The GOP leadership tried to pass a 5-year reauthorization of 702, and it failed on the floor. An 18-month renewal reportedly pushed by President Trump also failed. So the reason both failed, roughly 20 House Republicans, many of them like the Freedom Caucus, joined with the House Democrats to block it. So a true bipartisan, like positive outcome for now, for the moment. And this is like a rare cross-aisle coalition. And the Senate passed the 10-day extension after that, which means the Senate also does not have clean authorization votes locked in. So, you know, what the holdouts want. Like, what are they asking for? So they're asking, or they're not trying to kill Section 702. Most of them are fine with the Foreign Intelligence Corps. What they're holding out for is their real, like, reform aspect. So specifically, first, a probable cause warrant requirement before the FBI can search Section 702 data for information about U.S. persons. right? This is the single most important reform on the table right now. The FBI can run queries on the 702 database using an American's name, phone number, or email address without a warrant. So the proposed reform would require them to get a warrant, just like they would for any other search of a U.S. person's communications. Second, closing the data broker loophole. This is where the government goes around the warrant requirements entirely by buying location data, browsing data, communications, metadata from commercial data brokers. So the reform would stop that. And then third, the stronger minimization. So better transparency reporting, actual consequences for past documented abuse. And what the EFF is saying, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they published a piece on April 17th titled Keep Pushing, We Get 10 More Days to Reform Section 702. So the core message of the EFF, and I agree with this, is do not accept a clean extension that quietly rolls into a long-term reauthorization without the warrant requirements. So the pressure is working. The cross-aisle coalition is real, or at least appears to be from what we can see. And this is the strongest like leverage moment privacy advocates have had on Section 702 and the entire history of it existing. So if you're a United States listener, this is a really important phone call that you need to make this week, probably this month, but definitely this week. Write this number down, right? The Capitol switchboard is 202-224-3121. Call that number, ask for your House representative, then call it again and ask for your senators. Each call takes a couple of minutes. And then here's what you say. You say, hey, my name is Simon. I'm a constituent from zip code blah. I'm calling about Section 702 of FISA. I do not support a clean reauthorization. I do support reform that requires a probable cause warrant before the FBI can search Section 702 data for information about Americans. And I do support closing the data broker loophole. Thank you. That's it. That's the entire call. You don't need to argue. Don't need to go into a debate. Don't, you know... The staffer will log the call, and the call will tally. Like the office will tally those calls, fors and against, support and opposition. And the representatives count these calls. They do respond to volume. And cross aisle votes are rare, and they are rare precisely because constituents don't usually push on these matters. They don't call about this stuff. So the ones who are pushing right now are outnumbering the ones saying, just reauthorize it. Like no one's constituents aren't calling and saying, hey, yeah, just reauthorize it. This is good for us. Like they're just not. So the more people that can call, the bigger influx we get, like the more amplification we get, right? So there's a 10-day extension instead of a 5-year rubber stamp. So don't underestimate your voice on this. Just make the call. So that's my call. Well, I feel like I'm asking people to do homework, but it's really important. So you know, just quick recap. Right, we have Brussels. They built the age verification app. Researcher cracked it in 2 minutes. No one's listening to them. We have this HR 8250, this Parents Decide Act, where it would push the same thing here. So call your representatives and tell them you don't want that. Then we got Meta reporting. You know, reportedly from New York Times, you know, preparing for this facial recognition for Ray-Ban smart glasses, you know. So we have people fighting, but that's, you know, another thing that you can call your representative as well. Of course, we talked about Signal and Vercel and local AI, but, you know, the other call to action would be on that Section 702, making that phone call. And that's a wrap. That's everything. I know that was a lot. I feel like it was a lot. I hope I didn't feel like I was just basically being an advocate for not protesting, but for being an activist, because that's what I'm hoping we can do is with our community. I hope we can actually spark some change. And because otherwise, I don't know what we're doing here other than just talking about cool stuff we can do to circumvent all the bad things that are happening. But if we can do this and we can call and we can make this happen, then we get these wins, it will just, it'll be good for everybody. So whatever gate they build, somebody will crack it, right? And whatever promise they make about your data, assume it's already broken. Even your own operating system, right? Depending upon what you run, these things are basically going to be working against you and not for you. And I don't want to see that happen. I want us to be able to thrive in our expression, our creativity, the way we communicate, the way we share ideas, and kind of just be able to keep making cool things and building cool stuff and all of that without this massive overreach and this kind of dystopian apparatus of surveillance tech, you know, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and swallowing up everything. I think it really does stifle creativity. I think it stifles true, genuine conversations and discourse. And, you know, once we lose that, we kind of lose our humanity. So I didn't mean for this to turn into such a philosophical ending, but I do like ending on a positive note. So I kind of wanted to like bring the energy back up through your speakers, if that makes any sense. Cool. I've got actually a couple cool things coming up. I'm going to be actually attending a talk on OpenClaw, ironically enough, by Matt Hill this week, who I interviewed back in like episode 23, I think, or 26, CEO or one of the co-founders of Start9 Labs. They have StartOS, which is basically an environment for you to be able to self-host things like Nextcloud and Bitcoin nodes and all that cool stuff. So he's giving a presentation, and I'm going to... I'm going to go see that. So I will have hopefully some fun stuff to report on. I've got a couple other things in the queue. One of them is on Reticulum and a couple other things that I'm working on. I don't want to mention yet because I don't know if they'll fall through or not. So I'll just kind of hope that they don't. And hit me up. Send me if there's any topics or something you want me to look at, let me know. Shoot me an email, hit me on the socials, drop into the Matrix chat room. Any of those things would be awesome. And really, really just enjoyed a lot of the conversations that have been happening in the group chats. So much. Guys are awesome. Like, we have some cool ass people. This really is like a good time. I started this podcast because I didn't know anyone in this space. I just really wanted some friends. And so now I look in the Matrix chat, I have 450 of them. So I think that's pretty cool. I think that says a lot and about, everyone. So hopefully see you there soon. And until next time, y'all get on that phone and start calling those representatives. I want people to email me, Nostra me, tweet me, jump in the chat. Just say, hey, I made the call, Simon. Thanks for getting the word out. All right. I'll catch you on the flip side. I'm gonna show you I'm with it. I've been really happy you to sit and watch me win again and win again and win again. I know it's probably getting on me and winning synonyms. So if I ever win again, it's nobody the minimum. I didn't have to sell my soul.